This is a download from the BBC. For details of our huge new range of audio for free download or podcast and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcast.
This is Mercado Madrid Fish Market. It's the largest in Europe and the second largest in the world. About 130,000 tons of fish pass through here each year. And before dawn, while most of the city is still sleeping, Mercado Madrid is alive, a teeming hall full of stalls selling just about anything you can think of. Staples like hake and anchovy, squid, farmed mussels by the sackful, crabs and lobsters still twitching in their boxes, sharks and eels. Traditionally, the lorries would bring their catches here from ports like Vigo, but now it's an international business, and you can find fish and shellfish here from as far away as Namibia, Argentina, Chile, Ecuador, Vietnam and Canada.
Mercado Madrid is thriving at the moment, but for how much longer? Can the supply of food from the sea continue to arrive as it has done for centuries? Jesus Jimenez, who works at the market, is noticing some changes.
There are fewer fish, yes, particularly anchovies. They're a Spanish favourite, so we notice there aren't many of them. I'm no biologist, but according to biologists, in some species they're starting to notice a decline. On the other hand, sometimes fishermen turn up with loads of fish, so we don't know if they're running out or not. And because this market has fish coming in from all over the world, it's hard to tell. But I have noticed the anchovies, because they're a national fish that traditionally come from Spanish ports, so we notice that they're not fresh anymore, because they're coming from further away.
Many millions of us, billions even, depend on fish as a source of protein, but the signs are that we won't be able to depend on it for much longer. I'm Richard Black, and in this BBC One Planet programme, I'll be looking at what's happening to the fish in the sea. All over the world, stocks are being depleted. Some, it appears, will never recover. And you can't help wondering if a visitor to Mercado Madrid in 50 years' time would see any anchovies, or cod, or tuna, or octopus. Perhaps plankton burgers and jellyfish soup would be all that's left. Of course, fish farming might provide an answer. That's a topic for a future programme. Or perhaps we'll find ways of managing wild fisheries better. According to Carl Gustav Lundin, head of the Global Marine Programme at the World Conservation Union, or IUCN, we're not doing a very good job of it now.
I think there's every reason to believe that we have a serious issue on our hands when it comes to marine fisheries. We have significantly altered almost all of the main fish stocks out there. In the case of larger fish, we've probably reduced the numbers down to less than 10% of the big fish. I think there's very compelling arguments that this actually has a very significant spillover effect on other parts of the ecosystem. I think overfishing is the biggest problem. Clearly, climate change is having a very significant impact in many systems as well. And the compounded effect of marine pollution, climate change, overfishing, habitat modifications, all contribute to a system in crisis.
One of the most dramatic pieces of evidence for a global crisis emerged last year in the shape of a vast survey from Dalhousie University in Canada. By looking at historical data on catches and biological changes in coastal waters, Boris Vorm and his team came up with a worrying conclusion about the trend which shows more and more fish stocks collapsing.
We projected that if this trend that was very consistent over the last 50 years would continue the same way as it has, then we could face a future without consumable fish species by the mid-century or so. In fact, Food and Agriculture Organization, which oversees world fisheries, concludes that there's very, very little room for expansion in any of these resources, and about 75% of stocks are either fully exploited, meaning they're up to the limit, or they're already overexploited or depleted.
In 1497, when the Venetian explorer John Cabot reached the shores of Newfoundland in what's now northeastern Canada, he found that cod were so plentiful they could be hauled up in buckets. Within a century, many of the cod would be finding their way, salted and dried, to the dinner tables of Europe. Nearly five centuries later, in 1992, the picture looked very different.
One union official calls it the biggest layoff in Canadian history. The two-year moratorium on the northern cod fishery was expected, but yesterday's announcement was still greeted with rage.
stations down the line, passed out.
Cod stocks off the Newfoundland coast had reached a critical level, and the response of the Canadian government was to close the fishery completely. They said for 2 years. 15 years later, there's still little sign of recovery for fish stocks or fishing communities.
The impact was significantly devastating for thousands and thousands and thousands of people in hundreds of fishing communities throughout Newfoundland and Labrador.
Tom Best was one of a group of local fishermen and industry workers who'd predicted the collapse, but whose warnings had been ignored.
They were talking 2 years, and now we know that this is now 2007. That's 15, 16 years later, and we're still there. Thousands of them have had to uproot. Their sons and daughters see no opportunity in the fishing industry, and their families are moving on. The survival of the cod fishery and other fisheries is what the coastal fishing villages depend on. We want to talk in reality. You are seeing a way of life disappear.
One of the reasons for the increase in overfishing in recent years has been the continuing advancement of fishing technologies. Whereas Tom Best fished in a way that hadn't really changed much for hundreds of years, he was competing with industrial fleets of vast ships equipped with all the latest gadgets. Sonar and tracking devices to locate shoals of fish, huge nets the size of several jumbo jets, heavy trawls that drag across the ocean floor, and GPS systems. And according to Tom Best, Canadian fisheries managers were sucked into a global competition. If they didn't catch all the fish, someone else would. It was a race with no winners.
The argument was used that in order to compete in the international marketplace, when we talk about cod product and other things, that we had to be competitive on a year-round basis. So the justification for all this technology came from academics and from the legal representatives of these offshore companies and from politicians to suggest that, you know, that we're not going to have any presence in a significantly highly developing international fishing industry unless we have the wherewithal to catch all these species year-round. Well, in a short period of 40 or 50 years, we have certainly done one thing. We allowed that to happen for a few years, and now we can't compete with anyone because we don't have any cod resource to sell in the international marketplace.
Newfoundland's great cod rush created so much havoc in the local ecosystem that Boris Vorm suggests it may never recover.
When I say the ecosystem has changed, what I mean is that other species have increased in abundance, species that usually were preyed upon by cod, things like herring, capelin, sandlands, for example, that are now thought to prey heavily on the larvae and eggs of cod. So it's like a reversal of predator of prey. The prey now is a predator because it can prey very efficiently, effectively on the larvae and eggs of cod, and that may diminish the ability of cod to come back.
You might think that with the Newfoundland experience to draw on, the fishing industry would now be better regulated so that nothing like it could happen again. Boris Vorm's research suggests otherwise. At the moment, individual governments manage fishing grounds within their exclusive economic zones, usually extending 200 nautical miles or 370 kilometres offshore. Now, that might work for some types of fish or shellfish that live within a confined area. But where does it leave those rangers of the oceans, the species like tuna and swordfish that can flit across a country's waters in a mere day?
The problem with tuna, swordfish, marlins, and other highly migratory fishes is that they spend most of their life out on the high seas. The high seas are a particularly difficult place to manage because they are, by law, the common heritage of all mankind, meaning they're almost open access. So a lot of the tuna stocks in the Atlantic, for example, are severely depleted. Bluefin tuna is at less than 10% of what they used to be. And the overfishing is continuing despite scientific advice to the contrary.
Bluefin tuna are perhaps the most amazing fish on the planet. Weighing in at more than half a ton, they can accelerate as fast as the streamlined sports cars that their sleek profiles resemble. Unusually for fish, they've evolved to be warm-blooded, allowing them to swim and hunt from the tropics to the coldest waters. Unfortunately for them, they're also delicious to eat. Fish like the bluefin, which span international waters, are supposed to be managed by groups of countries coming together in bodies called regional fisheries management organisations. In the case of the Atlantic bluefin, the body responsible is the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tuna, or ICAT. In November 2006, following years of warnings that stocks were declining fast, ICAT published a 15-year management plan aiming to help the bluefin recover. Spain has both industrial and traditional bluefin tuna fleets in the Mediterranean, where many of the fish spawn. Rafael Centenera is General Assistant Director at the Spanish Fisheries Ministry, and he spoke to the BBC about the bluefin tuna situation.
There's a problem in the fishery, for sure. That's why we need a recovery plan, because they usually catch fishes of more than 140 kilos as an average, and in the last 5-10 years, they have seen a reduction on the average size. That means you're catching more spawning stock, part of the spawning stock.
ICAT's recovery plan was criticised in some quarters for ignoring the advice of its own scientists. The scientists had advised cutting annual quotas by about a half, but the politicians could only agree to a cut of 25%. Scientists also advised closing the tuna fishery in June to protect spawning stock. Politicians found that too restrictive.
You know, the problem is that the fishery is taking place when you can fish the fishes. If you close it, okay, we close the fishery of tuna. That's the other alternative.
Really? Because there, purse there would be no purse seine fishery of tuna at all.
Yeah, because if you close the month of June, you're closing the fishery. Okay, that means that all the people that is living on that, and it's a lot of people, is going to go home with no compensation. For sure, we are friends of fish, but we are still more friends of fishermen.
Regional organisations such as ICAT actually have very little power. They can't punish or make laws. They also exist essentially to maintain fishing, not to reduce it. ICAT's Assistant Executive Secretary is Victor Restrepo.
Their main mandate is to have fisheries, to allow fisheries to exist in a sustainable manner. So the sustainable part forces them to be conservation organisations. But their objective is definitely one of creating fishing opportunities.
Victor admits that the new management plan for bluefin is far from fail-safe.
The outlook is very negative right now, and it's only fair to imagine that if these controls don't work, things are going to stay the same or get worse.
So you would see the amount of fish declining each year, and perhaps commercial extinction?
Yes, that's one possibility that could happen, that the catches will go down because of the stock goes down, and there could be commercial extinction, at least for a large part of the fleet.
This is why many observers believe the system of regional fisheries management organisations isn't working. The governments which in the end control the organisations are the same ones supporting their own fishing fleets, and sometimes the places where demand from consumers is strong. With bluefin, the key country on the demand side is Japan. The price a tuna can command in Tokyo varies, but if you talked of a single fish fetching tens of thousands of dollars, you wouldn't be far wrong.
As you know, Japanese people love the sashimi, as well, that is fresh raw fish, and tuna is the king of sashimi.
Misanori Miyahara is Director of Fishery Coordination at the Japanese Fisheries Agency, and also Japan's delegate to ICAT.
In case of bluefin tuna, yes, Japan is consuming majority of the production of bluefin tuna.
So where is this tuna coming from? Is it being caught by Japanese vessels on the high seas, or is it coming from Europe, or is it being imported from...
The main source is Japanese coastal water.
Right.
We are catching bluefin tuna over 10,000 metric tons. Import is also an important source for us, too, in case of bluefin.
Mainly from the Mediterranean?
Mediterranean, Mexico, and small part is from Australia. That is called southern bluefin.
How is that fishery around Japanese coastal waters, how is that fishery regulated?
We are controlling mainly effort control, vessel numbers, and we have very strict licensing system for bluefin fishery.
Even so, the southern bluefin tuna is categorised by the World Conservation Union as being critically endangered, so mm-hmm. one could deduce from that all the controls haven't been working very well.
Mm-hmm. In case of southern bluefin, that was a bad example for our management effort.
It's a bad example?
Yes.
What went wrong?
Our enforcement was not sufficient. That's it. And also we had lots of IUU, so-called illegal, unreported catches too.
By Japanese vessels or from other nations?
By foreign vessels, by various flagged vessels.
Is that situation now being changed?
Yes, we rectified the situation.
How did you do that?
We strengthened our inspection and other enforcement activities. And at the same time, we engaged in a very strict inspection before custom clearance of tuna products.
Japan claims a degree of success in combating illegal, unregulated and unreported fishing, or IUU to give it its unwieldy acronym. It appears that European countries have not been so diligent. ICAT scientists estimate that the actual Mediterranean bluefin catch in recent years has been anywhere between 25% and 50% higher than the legal quota. Changing this picture is a key aim of the ICAT management plan, but Mr. Miyahara is not convinced that European fleets are obeying the new rules.
Last year we adopted, and ICAT adopted a so-called rebuilding plan, but of course that is not sufficient. But more important part was full compliance to that program. But if you see the situation this year, that is not the case. For example, some fishing fleets operated even after the closure of the fishing season, that is the end of June. So, you see, we are very concerned.
To some extent, Mr. Miyahara's view is backed up by the European Commission, which announced at the end of September it was bringing legal proceedings against seven EU states for failing to report bluefin catches properly. Conservation groups believe there are many other problems. They filmed light aircraft scanning the Mediterranean for tuna, which is supposed to be banned now. They believe catcher boats may sometimes be transferring their hauls illegally to transport vessels, making it impossible to monitor how much is being caught. Sebastian Losada, oceans campaigner at Greenpeace Spain, believes that with the current situation, illegal fishing is inevitable and the ICAT measures need to be stronger.
The root of the problem is that we have capacity in the region. We have a number of fishing vessels that are actually able to catch probably double the quota. And they are not only able to do it, but they need to do it to be profitable. So it's not an option. If all this fleet leave port, they actually have to fish a minimum amount of bluefin tuna if you want to get back the money that you invested in the fishery. And that means the wages of the crew members, that means the fuel that you are burning.
The way the industry is structured means that there will inevitably be illegal fishing.
Yeah, and then, of course, you can improve control and you can do a lot, but in the end, in the medium to long term, you need to have a fishing capacity that is in line with the resources that you have available. You have double the capacity, there's no way in the end that you'll be able to properly manage a fishery.
Bluefin tuna could serve as a symbol for everything that's wrong with fisheries regulation today. It's delicious to eat, so we demand more and more. Fleets compete with ever more advanced technology to meet that profitable demand. And some governments turn a blind eye to regulation in order to keep their fleets happy. The long-term planning that would rebuild stocks to a healthy state, permitting large-scale catches again, appears to be absent. And the decline in fish stocks doesn't just affect human consumers. Fish and shellfish and squid and octopus and everything else in the oceans are parts of ecosystems which have evolved over countless millennia and are still evolving. So what's the environmental impact of losing large predators such as tuna? Boris Vorm.
Tuna schools, particularly in the Pacific but in other places as well, they're often associated with schools of dolphins and seabirds. It's almost like a symbiosis between those species because the tuna schools, they bring the prey fish, the small fish, up to the surface, chase them up to the surface, and where they're concentrated by dolphins, herding them into tighter aggregations, and then they're harvested from above by the seabirds, which can't obviously go very deep into the water to catch fish. So tuna, dolphins, and seabirds, to some extent, rely on each other in making these prey fish available for feeding. And if the tuna are greatly depleted, that may have effects on dolphins and seabirds.
And overfishing may even be affecting the evolutionary development of certain species.
Fishing, in a Darwinian sense, acts as a huge selective pressure on fish stocks to reproduce before they get caught and killed. So in many fish stocks around the world, we see that the age of maturity is going down, so the fish are becoming sexually mature younger and younger at a smaller and smaller size when they're still passing through the nets and still can't be caught. On the Scotian shelf here, we see that haddock, which used to be a fairly solitary bottom-feeding fish is now a swarming midwater fish that's slower growing and much skinnier than they used to be. Some people have said this is almost like a different species now, and it's an evolutionary change that's probably to a large extent caused by fishing.
It's just before dawn in the fishing port of Vigo in Galicia in northwestern Spain. It's said to be the largest fishing port in the world. In giant sheds along the quay, fishermen who've just returned are lining up to auction their catches. Other people are waiting to buy. Some are the big traders who will take their produce to Madrid and further afield. But there are a number of local women as well, who will spend the morning preparing octopus and squid to sell from stalls in a town square. Seafood clearly plays a very big part in their lives.
Daughters eat a lot of fish, different kinds of fish, but every day, for sure, seguro.
Does it keep you healthy if you eat lots of fish and seafood? Do you ever worry that at some point there might not be enough fish in the sea, that in fact there might not be enough wild fish left to eat?
Fishermen in places like Vigo aren't only struggling against the decline in local fish stocks. Cheap imported products also keep prices artificially low. With the auctions done, the morning sun shines down prettily on the boats moored along the quay, proud in their blue, green and red liveries. I climb down onto the deck of one to meet José Antonio Ferreira, president of the Vigo Fishermen's Association.
Well, I'm 52 now, and I started at the age of 18. That's 34 years I've been at sea. The truth is, my son's already starting to question the amount of responsibility that comes with owning a small fishing boat. Coastal fishing in Galicia, well, in the whole of Spain really, is made up of family companies.
As a fisherman and as someone who represents other fishermen, are you worried about overfishing and depletion of stocks?
Yes, I'm worried. But we don't go to fish. We go to fish money. We prefer to work less and catch fish that was worth more. Of course it worries me. It's my livelihood we're talking about. But the economic problem is more pressing. It's really hard to find anyone these days who wants to be a fisherman because you don't earn anything at sea. It's not hard to find the fish. The main problem is that the price being paid for the fish is the same as it was 20 years ago.
A lot of the fish imported to industrialized countries that helps keep prices so low comes from access agreements allowing mainly European Union, Asian and North American fleets to fish the coastal waters of Africa and South America. Director of the Fisheries Centre at the University of British Columbia, Daniel Pauly, has analysed these agreements.
The fish supply to the US, European, Asian markets is supplied mainly from developing countries by now. About 56 or 57%, depending on whether you're talking about bulk or whether you're talking about value. It is the developing world that, in terms of fish, feeds the developed world, and moreover, that prevents the collapse of the stocks in the developed countries from being noticeable to the consumer.
But what effect is this having on diets and livelihoods? Dr. Sloane Chimotiro is fisheries advisor to NAPAD, the New Plan for Africa's Development, an initiative of the African Union.
Almost 200 million people in Africa depend directly on fish for food. And we also know that fish is a very important source of animal protein. In some of the countries along the coast, close to 60% of the animal protein comes from fish. So people eat more fish than they do eat chicken or beef.
Have you come across any examples where the involvement of other countries or other companies has really affected the ability of local fishers to catch fish?
We have reports that talk about kind of conflict between large-scale fishing operators and the locals, which has a huge impact on the livelihoods of these people, because sometimes the locals may not be able to catch fish, exploit the fishing grounds properly.
What's been happening along parts of the African coast exemplifies a global trend which Boris Vorm and other scientists have identified, a trend you might call serial depletion. Industrial fleets exhaust one area or one species and move on to another. So long as there is something else to move on to, the food keeps coming. But what about when there isn't anything else to move on to, which Boris Vorm's study suggests may happen within our children's lifetimes?
I think the situation is very dire, yeah, and I don't think we over-exaggerated. I'm actually optimistic that we have the capacity to turn this trend around, and I would concede that locally there have been some successes to do just that. It's just when you look at the overall global picture, which few people actually do, most people think about fisheries very regional, but when you look at it globally, it is a very difficult situation, and there's no evidence yet that we have been successful in reversing the trend of depletion of fisheries. I would still stand by that conclusion.
If Boris Vorm is right, the future looks pretty bleak for fish and marine ecosystems and everyone who likes eating wild seafood. It's a global crisis which has only been tackled effectively in a handful of places around the world. And as the human population of Earth expands, so will the demand for fish. So what can we do about it? Aquaculture, fish farming, has been touted as one answer. But it can come with a heavy environmental price tag. In next week's edition of the BBC's One Planet, I'll be asking whether aquaculture will be able to feed human mouths hungry for fish when the wild no longer can.